We apologize for interrupting classical music on KPR. Important new severe weather information to bring you. The National Weather Service has issued a severe thunderstorm warning for northwestern Doniphan County in northeastern Kansas and central Holt County in northwestern Missouri. This is until 2 p.m. Minutes ago, a severe thunderstorm was located near Rulo, or about 11 miles east of Falls City, moving northeast at 80 miles an hour. And the storm is producing 60-mile-an-hour wind gusts and penny-sized hail, and is expected to damage roofs, siding, and trees. This is affecting Highland, Forest City, White Cloud, Denton, Big Lake, Severance, Leona, Iowa Point, Fanning, Bendena, and Iowa Reservation of Kansas and Nebraska. This warning also includes I-25 between the mile markers of 78 and 82. If you're in the warned area, move to an interior room on the lowest floor of a building. This is a severe thunderstorm warning until 2 p.m. for northwestern Doniphan and central Holt County. Until 1:45 p.m., severe thunderstorm warnings continue for southeastern Nemaha, northwestern Jackson, and Brown County. An update on that storm came a few minutes ago. At last report, the storm is located along a line extending from near Reserve to 7 miles northeast of Emmett. Also moving northeast at 60 miles an hour, this storm producing 70-mile-an-hour wind gusts. There have been multiple reports of 60 to 70-mile-an-hour wind gusts in eastern Nemaha County. This is expected to cause considerable tree damage, as well as damage to mobile homes, roofs, and outbuildings. Severe thunderstorm warning in effect until 1:45 for southeastern Nemaha, northwestern Jackson, and Brown County. We'll bring you the very latest in severe weather information as we receive it from the National Weather Service. We'll send you back to classical music. Keep it here on Kansas Public Radio. From Beethoven, Violin Sonata No. 1 in D, played by violinist Gideon Kremer and pianist Marta Argerich on Kansas Public Radio. Support for classical music on KPR comes from the University of Kansas, transforming students and society through academics, discovery, service, and spirit. Information about the possibilities of a KU education is online at ku.edu. A severe thunderstorm warning remains in effect until 1:45 for north-central Jackson and Brown counties. A few minutes ago, severe thunderstorms were located along a line extending from near Rulo to about 3 miles southeast of Circleville, moving northeast at 60 miles an hour, producing 70-mile-an-hour wind gusts. Considerable tree damage, as well as damage to homes, roofs, and outbuildings, is expected. Severe thunderstorm warning in effect until 1:45 for north-central Jackson and Brown counties. Until 2 p.m., we have a severe thunderstorm warning in effect for northwestern Doniphan County and central Holt County. This storm is likewise producing 60-mile-an-hour wind gusts and penny-sized hail. Also expected to damage roofs, siding, and trees. Severe thunderstorm warning in effect until 2 p.m. for northwestern Doniphan and central Holt counties. In addition to that, we have strong thunderstorms, not yet considered severe thunderstorms, but strong nonetheless, that will impact southeastern Morris, southwestern Shawnee, southern Waubunsee, western Osage, and Lyon counties, and that'll be through 2 p.m. as well. Here, Doppler radar tracking strong thunderstorms along a line extending 4 miles southwest of Eskridge to 3 miles northeast of Americus, moving northeast at 55 miles per hour. The storms in this area producing 50-mile-an-hour winds and half-inch hail. Strong thunderstorms until 2 p.m. affecting southeastern Morris, southwestern Shawnee, southern Waubunsee, western Osage, and Lyon counties. Keep it tuned right here for the latest in severe weather as we receive it from the National Weather Service. Daniel Barenboim and the members of Staatskapelle Berlin join us next with music by Claude Debussy and his great masterpiece La Mer, or the Sea, on KPR. Debussy's La Mer, or The Sea, played by Staatskapelle Berlin, led by Daniel Barenboim, on Kansas Public Radio, KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence, KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia, KANV and KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City, KANQ Chanute, online at kansaspublicradio.org. Support for news on KPR comes from Spider Arc Constructors, offering hardscaping across the KPR listening area, including patios and retaining walls. More information about creating your backyard oasis is at SpiderArt, Spider with a Y, SpiderArtConstructors.com.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The White House says President Biden does not view the people who support former President Donald Trump as garbage. Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre.
He is a president for all. It doesn't matter if you live in a red state. It doesn't matter if you live in a blue state. He has said this himself. I have said it on his behalf.
Karine Jean-Pierre holding a briefing a short time ago in the wake of Biden's rebuke of a joke at Trump's New York City rally Sunday. A comedian described Puerto Rico as an island of garbage. During a call with a Latino voting advocacy group, Biden made a garbage comment as he then referenced Trump supporters. Biden later said that was not what he meant. The U.S. Supreme Court is allowing Virginia to resume its purge of registered voters that the Commonwealth says removes foreign nationals from the rolls. But as NPR's Jude Joffe Block reports, U.S. citizens have also been affected.
In a 6-3 decision, the Supreme Court granted Virginia's emergency appeal to block a lower court ruling that would have stopped Virginia's voter purge and would have promptly restored 1,600 voters to the rolls. Instead, Virginia can continue its purge and does not need to restore voters to the rolls. But Virginia does allow in-person voter registration through Election Day, so eligible U.S. citizens who were mistakenly removed from the rolls can still vote in this election. Jude Joffe Block, NPR News.
Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin says North Korean troops are moving into the Kursk region bordering Ukraine, and Austin says the North Koreans are carrying in Russian equipment. Appearing alongside his South Korean counterpart at a press conference today in Washington, the defense secretary said the likelihood is pretty high that Russia will use its allies in combat. He's characterizing it as a dangerous development, one that could expand or prolong the conflict. An annual report in the medical journal The Lancet finds that climate change is harming people's health more than ever. The report came out just ahead of this year's international climate negotiations in November. Here's NPR's Alejandro Barundo.
Climate-worsened disasters like Hurricane Helene and intense summer heat waves are actively hurting people's health and sometimes even killing them. That's a key finding of this year's Lancet countdown. Marina Romanello is a researcher at University College London and the director of the annual report.
And what we're seeing is that people all around the world in every country are already facing record-breaking threats to their well-being, to their health, and to their survival from the rapidly changing climates.
There are some bright spots in this year's report, too. A growing number of countries have now at least assessed their health system's vulnerability to climate change. But Romanello says almost no countries are doing enough to stop the root cause of the problem, burning fossil fuels. Alejandra Borunda, NPR News.
From Washington, this is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from Progressive Insurance, where drivers can compare direct rates using Progressive's rate comparison tool. Customers can see options and rates side by side. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. We're live. We're local. We are Kansas Public Radio. Strauss Symphony Orchestra, led by Alfred Walter, with Valslint, or the Slow Waltz, from composer Oscar Strauss, on Kansas Public Radio. I'm Jeff Watson, happy to be back with you. to share more classical music before All Things Considered rolls around at 3. In this hour, we'll hear music for flute and piano, a sonata by Paul Hindemith, and the enchanting 5 variants of Dives and Lazarus, the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields, later with music by Rayfon Williams. Support for classical music on KPR comes from the Topeka Symphony presenting Puttin' on the Ritz with Rimsky-Korsakov's Procession of the Nobles and Grieg's Piano Concerto performed by Chaeyoung Park on Saturday. Tickets at topekasymphony.org. Before we continue, just a look at the weather situation. Currently no active weather alerts, but this note from the National Weather Service that strong thunderstorms are going to impact western Jefferson, Shawnee, eastern Wabunsee, Osage, southeastern Pottawatomie and southern Jackson, and northeastern Lyon counties, all through 2:30 p.m. Doppler radar is tracking strong thunderstorms along a line extending from 4 miles north of Silver Lake to 3 miles northwest of Burlingame to near Neosho Rapids. Storms moving northeast at 60 miles an hour, currently producing 50 miles an hour winds and pea-sized hail. Those winds could knock down small tree limbs and blow around unsecured objects, and minor damage to vegetation possible. Strong thunderstorms affecting western Jefferson, Shawnee, eastern Wabunsee, Osage, southeastern Pottawatomie, southern Jackson, and northeastern Lyon counties through 2:30 p.m. And do keep it tuned here on KPR in case severe weather develops. We continue with music by Edvard Grieg, and like his famous Peer Gynt suites, what we'll listen to was some incidental music that he composed for a play put on in 1872, which told the story of a medieval king of Norway. We'll hear the Swedish Radio Symphony and conductor Asa-Pekka Salonen in the suite Sigurd Jorsalfar on Kansas Public Radio.
Thank you.
created in 1872. A suite of music from the play Sigurd Jorsafar by Edvard Grieg. Asa Pekka Salonen was conductor of the Swedish Radio Symphony on Kansas Public Radio, where it is 2:27. Still to come, the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields, with five variants of Dives and Lazarus by Ray Vaughan Williams. Support for classical music on KPR comes from Delta Dental of Kansas, reminding listeners that dental health is closely linked with overall health and to visit a dentist regularly. Dentists can be found at deltadentalks.com/find. And the Dole Institute of Politics, hosting former Congressman Luke Messer and Sherry Bustos for their series Congress in the 21st Century, Wednesday, November 13th, 4 p.m. More at doleinstitute.org. Next on KPR, we'll have along flutist Laurel Zucker, Mark Shapiro at the keyboard, to hear a sonata written in 1936, a sonata for flute and piano by Paul Hindemith on Kansas Public Radio.
Thank you. Thank you.
That music created in 1936 by Paul Hindemith. Sonata for flute and piano, played by Laurel Zucker and pianist Mark Shapiro on Kansas Public Radio. Just about 2:45 and 15 minutes to go until All Things Considered at 3 o'clock. Then later on tonight, classical music resumes at 7. Destiny is your host, as always in the evenings, and tonight we're featuring Amy Beach's Gaelic Symphony with Destiny, plus a very funny tune about a beachcomber. You'll also hear from some angels that will help keep those Halloween ghosts at bay. Destiny has the classical music for you tonight from 7 to 9 here on Kansas Public Radio. A quick note from the National Weather Service in Topeka. Until 3 p.m., strong thunderstorms are going to impact Jefferson, eastern Shawnee, Douglas, northeastern Osage, and southeastern Jackson counties until 3. Doppler radar is tracking strong thunderstorms along a line extending from 3 miles northeast of Hoyt to near Perry Lake to near Pleasant Grove. Storms are moving northeast at 55 miles an hour, and they're producing 50-mile-an-hour wind gusts. Small hail, gusty winds could knock down small tree limbs and blow around unsecured objects. Strong thunderstorms impacting Jefferson, eastern Shawnee, Douglas, northeastern Osage, and southeastern Jackson counties until 3. We'll leave you with the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields to enjoy music by Rayfon Williams that premiered in 1939 at the World's Fair in New York, an enchanting bit of music based on an old English hymnal, the five variants of Dives and Lazarus on KPR. five variants of Dives and Lazarus. Composed in 1939 by Ralph Vaughan Williams, played by the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields, led by Sir Neville Mariner, on Kansas Public Radio. And with that, it's almost 3 o'clock and about time for All Things Considered from NPR News. Hope you've enjoyed the music this afternoon. I've enjoyed sharing it with you. I'm Jeff Watson, and we'll be back together at noon tomorrow. Classical music awaits you tonight. Destiny is your host from 7 to 9. We're live. We're local. We are Kansas Public Radio from the University of Kansas. KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence, FM 91.5. KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia, FM 89.7. KANV and KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City, FM 91.3. KANQ Chanute, FM 90.3. And always online for you at kansaspublicradio.org. It's 3 o'clock.
Donald intends to use the United States military against American citizens.
In her closing argument for the campaign, Kamala Harris is hitting one message hard: that Donald Trump poses a danger to democracy.
For Wednesday, October 30th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Ahead this hour, an update on the toll of war in Lebanon.
We'll visit a hospital seeing a spike in burn cases from Israeli airstrikes.
We were packing our bags and getting ready to evacuate our home. My daughters were playing outside on the balcony, and then it happened.
Also, the Supreme Court allows Virginia to resume purging voter registrations.
And how a nonprofit is working to help older people living in older homes stay put.
We go in maybe for one issue, and we can identify four or five other issues that, if we're not fixing then and there, will become more magnified.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Vice President Kamala Harris is trying to move past President Biden's remark that sounded like he was calling people who support former President Trump garbage. At Joint Base Andrews, Harris noted that Biden clarified that he was specifically taking issue with the demonization of Latinos at a Trump rally Sunday, not Trump supporters. Harris says Biden has been a president for all Americans, regardless of party, and if elected, she says, so will she.
I've been very clear from my earliest years as a prosecutor. I never asked anyone, are they a Democrat or Republican? The only thing I ask folks is, are you okay? And that's the kind of president I will be.
But the GOP is still seizing on Biden's remarks, former President Donald Trump in Rocky Mount, North Carolina.
You know what? The truth is they've treated our whole country like garbage, whether they meant to or not, because they're grossly incompetent people, and they've destroyed our country.
Both Trump and Harris visited North Carolina, where polls put them in a tight race. House Speaker Mike Johnson is campaigning in dozens of swing districts across the U.S. to boost the GOP's prospects to keep the House majority. NPR's Deirdre Walsh reports Johnson's future is linked to the outcome.
Speaker Johnson has held the gavel for about a year, and out on the campaign trail, he talks about plans for another term.
When we take control again and we have unified government, when we have the White House, the Senate, and the House, we're going to have the most aggressive first 100 days agenda that Congress you've ever seen.
Johnson is touting his ties to GOP presidential nominee Donald Trump. He says border security is his top priority. Then Republicans will focus on extending Trump's tax cuts, passing legislation on energy and regulatory changes. Deirdre Walsh, NPR News.
Notably, Speaker Johnson also said that putting Trump back in the White House would clear the way for Republicans to do a, quote, massive overhaul of the Affordable Care Act, which currently provides health insurance to nearly 50 million Americans. Negotiations have resumed between Boeing and its striking machinist union. NPR's Joel Rose reports the sides were back at the bargaining table yesterday with a strike in its seventh week.
The machinist union, representing some 33,000 striking workers, said it had a, quote, productive face-to-face meeting with Boeing. The union said those talks were held with the assistance of Acting Secretary of Labor Julie Hsu. The work stoppage has crippled production at Boeing's airplane factories in the Pacific Northwest for more than 7 weeks. The financial impact on the company and its suppliers is mounting, although Boeing announced this week that it will raise billions of dollars by selling stock and other securities to shore up its balance sheet. The two sides have gotten closer on wages, but key issues, including retirement benefits, remain. Joel Rose, NPR News, Washington.
U.S. stocks end the day lower, with the Dow down 91 points to end the day at 42,141. The Nasdaq has closed down more than 100 points. You're listening to NPR News. The U.S. economy is still on solid footing. In the last quarter, it expanded at an annual rate of 2.8%, short of the 3% growth rate from the previous quarter. Another key economic indicator, the monthly jobs report, comes out Friday, just days ahead of the presidential election. China's sluggish economy and struggling stock market have led to a sharp drop in the number of billionaires in the country, but the soaring popularity of short videos has made the founder of TikTok's parent company the richest man in China. Here's NPR's John Ruich.
According to the Hurun China Rich List, there are now 753 people in China worth at least 5 billion yuan. That's 142 fewer than the previous year. 5 billion yuan is the equivalent of about $700 million. At the top of the pile is 41-year-old Zhang Yiming with a net worth of more than $49 billion. Zhang is the founder of ByteDance, which saw its global revenue leap 30% last year as short videos grew in popularity. The man he unseated, bottled water magnate Zhongshan Shan, slipped to number two. That bumped Pony Ma, who runs the tech giant Tencent, to number three. Hurun says it's the third year in a row that its China rich list has shrunk. John Ruich, NPR News.
China is declaring today's launch a complete success. A launch part of China's quest to expand its space exploration. The craft is carrying three taikonauts, a woman and two men, to China's space station. They'll spend the next 6 months conducting experiments. China's government is hoping to send a crew to the moon by 2030. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the U.S. Treasury's Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, committed to informing that companies may be legally required to file beneficial ownership information. More at fincen.gov/BOI.
From the University of Kansas, this is KPR, Kansas Public Radio.
Support for KPR comes from Z's Divine Espresso, offering organic coffees via drive-thru windows and inside at 1800 East 23rd Street and 2351 West 31st in Lawrence. CoffeeInLawrence.com.
Still expecting stormy weather this afternoon. Those storms that just rolled through Lawrence are not the main event at all. Stay tuned to KPR for weather coverage throughout the afternoon. It's 3:06.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Last night, 1 week before Election Day, Kamala Harris made her closing argument to the American people.
America, for too long, we have been consumed with too much division, chaos, and mutual distrust. And it can be easy, then, to forget a simple truth. It doesn't have to be this way.
Standing in front of the White House on the Ellipse in Washington, D.C., Harris spoke for about half an hour, reviewing the agenda she'd pursue as president.
I will enact the first ever federal ban on price gouging on groceries. I'll work to lower the cost of child care, which is out. And when Congress passes a bill to restore reproductive freedom nationwide, as president of the United States, I will proudly sign it into law.
And she drew stark contrasts between herself and Donald Trump.
And on day one, if elected, Donald Trump would walk into that office with an enemies list. When elected, I will walk in with a to-do list. Full of priorities of what I will get done for the American people. And I will...
NPR White House correspondent Deepa Shivaram watched the vice president's speech. Hi, Deepa.
Hey there.
Was there more to the setting than just the January 6th, 2021 symbolism?
I mean, I think part of it, Ari, was, you know, there is such a powerful statement to have Kamala Harris standing in front of the White House. And in her remarks, you know, she pointed back to the White House, literally, like she turned her back, pointed to it, and asked the people in the crowd to imagine what day one of a Trump administration would look like versus day one of a Harris administration. And she's really trying to draw this contrast of Trump having this enemies list, and that's what he would come in focusing on, versus Harris, she says, would have a to-do list of things that she wants to accomplish. It hones back to her sense of pragmatism that she is, like, kind of branding herself as in terms of a politician. You know, but I'll also say this is kind of a show of force, right? This is, according to the campaign, 75,000 people on the National Mall. It's the largest event that Harris has had in her campaign, running against someone, as we know, who is pretty focused on crowd sizes.
So when you listen to what she included in that 30-minute speech, in contrast to Trump's speech on Sunday that was more than an hour, what were the policy proposals that you think are most notable?
Well, there's a couple that I will say get really, you know, strong reactions from the crowds that she's going to. And this is not just in Washington, of course. This is in, you know, Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and in states all over the country. So one of them is this plan to make it more affordable to take care of your parents while also taking care of your children at home. And one thing I think is really interesting about Harris is that she really likes to bring her own personal experience when she lays out some of these plans. So when she talks about the at-home care for seniors plan, you know, she talks about her own experience caring for her mom who died of cancer. And she knows what it's like to, you know, have to try and help someone, you know, find food that they can keep down. And she really tries to bring a personal lens to this.
And speaking of plans, abortion has been front and center for Democrats ever since the Supreme Court overturned Roe versus Wade. Is that still kind of the leading talking point for the Harris campaign in this final week?
It's a huge one. I mean, keep in mind, this is the issue that really, you know, Harris took the lead on as vice president, and that certainly carried into her campaign for president here. And it's something that really fires up a lot of voters still, and particularly, like we had talked about earlier, some of those Republican voters, some of those independent voters who maybe, particularly women, who have maybe never voted for a Democrat before, but are really considering it this time in this election to cast their ballot for Harris. And she's really letting the folks who have been impacted by this lead the messaging. So there's been a lot of ads at a lot of her events. She has women who have been personally impacted, had life, you know, threatening experiences in the hospital because of restrictions on abortion rights, come and speak. And I will say, at a recent rally in Houston, you know, they had dozens of gynecologists, of obstetricians, come on stage in their white coats and talk about it from their perspective as well. So there has been a wide net cast on this issue, continues to be one that really fires up a lot of voters. And we'll see where it kind of falls into play in these last 7 days.
And let's note that while Democrats are focusing on Harris's speech today, Republicans are focusing on something that President Biden said on a call with Latino voters shortly before she spoke.
The only garbage I see floating out there is his supporters. His demonization of Latinos is unconscionable, and it's un-American.
Deepa, how is this playing out?
I mean, this isn't exactly on message for the Harris campaign, right? And Republicans, Trump, they're already using this clip to criticize Biden and Democrats. The White House did weigh in, and Biden posted on X trying to clarify his remarks from last night. He said he was referring to the comedian who made the remarks calling Puerto Rico garbage, and he was calling that rhetoric garbage, not Trump's supporters. But, you know, this really undercuts Harris's message at a time when she's only got a few days left here to convince Republican voters, independent voters, to cast their ballot for her. And today, as she headed out to North Carolina, Harris distanced herself from those comments. She said she strongly disagrees with any criticism of people based on who they vote for.
How do you expect to see Harris spending these final days?
I mean, it's just every swing state or bust, Ari. She's hitting all seven swing states, headed to North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin today. I will say she's also doing a lot more interviews than she has been the last couple months on podcasts, other types of, you know, non-traditional media. And she also sat down with a number of local TV stations in swing states. So last night, even before her rally, she was on the local news in states like Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan. It's really a matter of appearing in as many places as possible in these last final days of this election, reaching as many voters as possible. The campaign says last weekend they actually knocked on more than a million doors. So there is a lot of momentum in the final stretch here.
NPR White House correspondent Deepa Shivaram, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's go overseas now. More than 12,000 people in Lebanon have been injured by Israeli airstrikes. Now, those injuries commonly include burns. And the most severe cases end up in one particular hospital in Beirut. NPR's Arzu Rezvani takes us there. And a warning, this piece describes the toll Israel's war in Lebanon is taking on civilians, especially children.
There are no more beds available at the Jaitawi Hospital's burn center.
Every day we have several calls from the hospitals to transfer patients, but we cannot, of course, we cannot accept everybody because of the big flow of patients.
That's Dr. Ziad Suleiman. He's been a plastic and reconstructive surgeon here for the last 20 years, and he's never seen this wing of the hospital under so much strain.
What we have done, we have transferred staff from other wards to the burn units, and we are training staff about the burn and the trauma and complicated wounds, fractures, so it's complicated.
These severe burn cases Dr. Suleiman and his team are treating are from Israeli airstrikes. They started last year. After Hamas carried out its October 7th attack on Israel, Hezbollah started firing rockets from Lebanon in a show of solidarity. A low-grade conflict ensued, and then, last month, it turned into a full-fledged war. Israel killed Hezbollah's leader Hassan Nasrallah, sent ground troops into Lebanon, and expanded its airstrikes. Several high-ranking Hezbollah officials have been killed, but it's come at a huge cost.
This is Ivana.
Ivana Likbiri is the youngest patient in this burn unit. She's 18 months old and wrapped in bandages from head to toe. There's only enough room for a pink little pacifier. Her mother, Fatima, is at her bedside. She recounts the day her village, Deir Qanun Annar, was attacked.
We were packing our bags and getting ready to evacuate our home, and we thought we'd have time for a quick breakfast first. My daughters were playing outside on the balcony, and then it happened.
In a flash, the wood terrace the two little girls were playing on went up in flames.
I don't know what divine strength filled me, but I grabbed my girls from the fire and threw them over the balcony to save them.
Fatima now splits her time between two different hospitals where her daughters are getting treated for severe burns. There weren't enough beds for both girls to stay together. On this day, Fatima is at the bedside of little Ivana. Tomorrow, she'll swap places with her husband and visit 7-year-old Raha, who often asks if they'll ever return home and worries they'll end up on the streets.
This generation now knows war. My 7-year-old sees Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu on the television and says, "Mom, is this the man that is killing us? Will the Israelis come and kill us?"
Fatima says she doesn't know why her village was attacked. Israel claims it struck 1,600 Hezbollah targets across southern Lebanon in airstrikes that killed more than 500 people that day. How many were Hezbollah fighters is not clear. NPR asked the Israeli military why Fatima's village was hit. It said airstrikes can bring on, quote, secondary explosions, indicating the presence of munitions, rockets, and lethal missiles. This is what makes this war so cruel, so painful. Fighters and civilians, young and old, their fate is often intertwined. It's one that little Ivana narrowly escaped, badly wounded. Many of her first words are now just whimpers. Her mother tries to cheer her up, waving a doll the hospital got her. But the pain medication is starting to wear off. The road ahead for the Likbiri family is uncertain. But one thing is for sure, says Fatima. They will never return to the village they fled from, not even after the war ends. All the good memories of their life there, they're all gone. Arzu Rezvani, NPR News, Beirut.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
From the University of Kansas, this is KPR, Kansas Public Radio. We broadcast at 91.5 FM in Lawrence, 91.3 FM in Junction City. We're always online at kansaspublicradio.org.
Support for KPR comes from KTWU, Channel 11, local public television, where arts, entertainment, educational, and informational programming is offered daily. Details on the web at ktwu.org. KTWU, Channel 11, local public television.
Coming up, we are going to talk about the Supreme Court ruling that came down allowing the Commonwealth of Virginia to continue purging individuals from state voter rolls. Now, this is just 6 days before Election Day. Why is this so important? We will look into it with Jude Jaffe Block. Get an update of news headlines, and we'll talk about the U.S. economy, which actually grew in July. Stay tuned. Lots more news still to come.
Support for KPR comes from the Raven Bookstore, hosting local memoirist Louise Krug as she shares her book, How to Explain, November 7th at 7 p.m. More at ravenbookstore.com/events.
Much of the KPR listening area has seen some showers and thunderstorms already today, but I hasten to inform you this is not the main event that we have been warning you about for the last couple of days. We are expecting these storms to become much more severe as we head through the late afternoon into the evening. So stick with KPR. We'll let you know about any watches or warnings that are issued. Right now, we do have a severe thunderstorm watch in effect till 7 o'clock tonight for Doniphan County, Kansas. Over in Missouri, we have Andrew, Atchison, Buchanan, Holt, Nottoway counties under that watch as well. There is a tornado watch to the south and west of most of the KPR listening area. The only KPR-covered county that's in that tornado watch is Chase County.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Praquil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at zquil.com. From the John Templeton Foundation, funding interdisciplinary research and catalyzing conversations to inspire awe and wonder. Learn more at templeton.org. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Today, just 6 days before the election, the Supreme Court made a ruling allowing Virginia to continue purging individuals from state voter rolls. The state says it's removing ineligible non-citizens, but NPR's Jude Jaffe Block has spoken to U.S. citizen voters whose registrations were also canceled as part of the state's program. She joins us now. Hi, Jude.
Hi there.
Hi. Okay, so clarify for us what Virginia was doing and what the Supreme Court did today.
Well, states have a responsibility to clean up their voter rolls. And the key issue is they have to take care to not remove eligible citizens when they do that. Mm-hmm. And they also have to be mindful of when that's happening. Virginia has an ongoing program that's been continuing to remove people from the rolls who they believe are non-citizens based on documents they filed or forms they filled out at the DMV. But we've talked to some U.S. citizens, as you mentioned, who mistakenly were ensnared in this because one reason is those DMV forms can be confusing. So last Friday, a federal judge said Virginia was systematically removing voters too close to the election in violation of federal law. And the judge said Virginia had to stop and had to restore 1,600 voters back on the rolls who'd been removed since August. And then Virginia appealed up to the Supreme Court, which this morning blocked that lower court ruling from taking effect. And that allows Virginia to keep removing people from the rolls.
Got it. Okay, so Virginia can keep removing people from the rolls. But you spoke to U.S. citizens who have been affected by this, right? Like, what does this ruling mean for them?
Well, this is a really important point because Virginia does allow people to register in person all the way through Election Day. So that means that if anyone is eligible to vote who was mistakenly taken off the rolls, they can still vote. And this is Ryan Snow. He's an attorney with the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights under law.
They should feel confident in going down either, you know, during early voting through Saturday or on Tuesday on Election Day and fill out the same day registration form and cast their provisional ballot, and that ballot will be counted.
He said his organization and others are going to be monitoring that. And, you know, we spoke with a U.S. citizen in Lynchburg, Virginia, Nadra Wilson, and she was removed from the voter rolls as part of this program. And she was able to re-register, and she told me yesterday that she voted early.
Good. Okay, well, Jude, I know that you've done a lot of reporting about claims that non-citizens could vote illegally in this election. How does what's happening in Virginia tie into that?
Well, yeah, this narrative about non-citizens voting in large numbers, it's not backed by evidence, but it is being promoted by former President Trump and his allies. And a lot of election lawyers are concerned this is being used to sow doubt in the election. It could even potentially be used to challenge results. And we've also seen this narrative prompting policy. So Republican states like Virginia have been taking actions in the name of removing non-citizens, but these actions are sweeping up U.S. citizens. It happened in Alabama as well, where the state wound up acknowledging in court that its program to remove non-citizens mistakenly flagged more than 2,000 eligible voters. So voting rights groups are extremely concerned about this, and they strongly disagree with the Supreme Court action today.
Well, this decision from the Supreme Court comes less than a week from Election Day. What do legal experts say about the timing of all of this?
Yeah, well, so there's no written decision from the Supreme Court, so it's a little bit murky how to even interpret it. But I spoke with University of Baltimore law professor Kim Whaley. She said given that this was happening on the shadow docket and that two lower courts had already ruled against Virginia, that it's hard not to see this action by the Supreme Court as political and ideological. And I also spoke with Nate Persily. He's an election law expert at Stanford Law School. He said he was somewhat surprised. He says the fact that the court got involved on a case like this at the last minute means they don't plan to be sitting on the sidelines. It shows they're willing to be involved in some of the minutia of running an election. And we know a lot of litigation is headed their way this election season.
That is NPR's Jude Joffe Block. Thank you so much, Jude.
Thank you.
The U.S. has not built enough new homes for years. That means millions of people are living in places that are just old and falling into disrepair. Many of these people are seniors struggling to stay put as they age. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports on what that looks like for one couple.
Pat Haskins' red brick home in Silver Spring, Maryland, is about as old as she is, 72. There are family photos everywhere, and walls painted her favorite color.
Purple, purple, purple.
Purple, just like her toenails and slide-on sandals. Pat bought the house 2 decades ago, but living here's gotten harder as her partner James has suffered from diabetes.
James has one leg, and he's blind, and he has kidney failure.
Sitting outside on their steps, Pat shows how, for years, they struggled together to get him into the house.
So he would sit down and just go one by one with his butt.
Hauling himself up one step at a time while Pat grabbed under his arms to pull him up.
That's why I have arthritis in my back, you know, because of helping him.
They desperately needed a wheelchair ramp. Plus, the basement had started flooding when it rained. But like so many in older, cheaper housing, Pat could not afford those fixes. She'd been an elementary school science teacher with a small pension, but
I took my $30,000 out and I put my daughter through college. I don't regret it, but if I had kept the money, I wouldn't need the help that I need.
She's gotten help from a national nonprofit called Rebuilding Together, which makes repairs people need to stay put, especially seniors.
We are seeing it increase in terms of the need, but also the issues are becoming more significant.
Chloe Bernardi heads the group's local chapter in Montgomery County, Maryland.
We go in maybe for one issue, and we can identify 4 or 5 other issues that if we're not fixing then and there, will become more magnified.
One older couple living with a son and grandchildren spent a year with a hole in the roof catching rain in buckets. And she says letting problems go gets expensive.
We had replaced last year a HVAC system for a woman who's 100 living with one of her relatives but didn't have heat, so it was running off oil, so her bill was $700-$800 a month.
Last year, she says requests for help shot up 400%. Nationally, most repair programs like this are underfunded with years-long wait lists. Todd Swanstrom with the University of Missouri St. Louis says thousands of homes are lost to disrepair, making the affordable housing shortage worse. But it's a crisis that's often invisible.
We don't see the black mold inside the house that gives a kid asthma, or the fact that inadequate air conditioning means an elderly couple suffering from heat stroke.
Last year, Pat Haskins got a wheelchair ramp and a fix for her basement flooding.
I would come down the steps, and before I could get to the bottom step, it would come right up past my ankle.
The group Rebuilding Together patched a hole in the basement and directed water away from the outside stairwell where it had been gushing in.
You want a pillow under your head?
She checks on James in the bedroom.
You just want to lay right here.
Yeah.
Pat doesn't know where they'd go if they had to leave. Even though plenty more things need fixing, her only plan is to stay here forever. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Silver Spring, Maryland.
And that report was produced by NPR's Marisa Pinalosa.
This is NPR News.
4 years ago, a near riot broke out at a polling center in Detroit, Michigan.
I heard banging on the windows. I heard chanting, "Stop the count, stop the count." It was a hairy moment.
How poll workers in the city are preparing for this year's election. Tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Join us tomorrow morning beginning at 5 o'clock on your KPR stations, 5 to 9 a.m. Morning Edition coming your way. Jay Schaefer will be your local host.
Support for KPR comes from the Lawrence Public Library, offering the New York Times and Washington Post online, Ancestry.com, and more. All available with a library card. Card information at lplks.org.
Still expecting severe storms to move through the KPR listening area tonight. I'll give you an update on the weather in just a few moments, plus regional news headlines. It's 73 degrees in Lawrence, 70 in Topeka, since we just had some rain move through. The time is 3:30.
All things considered from NPR News, I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ilse Chang. Coming up, voters in the Pacific Northwest have leaned reliably blue for decades.
At the top of the ticket, down ballot, different story.
This race is going to be close, within the margin of error. Don't think for 1 minute it's not going to come down to just a few thousand votes that are going to separate us.
First, this news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. A Pennsylvania state court has weighed in again on a long-running legal fight over mail-in ballots in the key swing state. As NPR's Hansi Luong tells us, this case could play a role in determining who wins the presidential contest in Pennsylvania next week.
Pennsylvania law requires mail-in ballots to be returned in envelopes with a current handwritten date. Those dates are not used to verify whether the ballot arrived on time, and voting rights groups have filed multiple lawsuits arguing that not counting mail-in ballots that arrive on time but without the date handwritten by the voter violates Pennsylvania's constitution, which says that all elections in the state must be free and equal. The Commonwealth Court of Pennsylvania agreed in a new ruling for a lawsuit over these so-called undated ballots in an earlier special election in Philadelphia. That ruling, however, is likely to be appealed to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, which recently ruled that undated and misstated ballots should not be counted. Hansi Luong, NPR News.
Many teachers in the federally funded Head Start program work odd jobs to make ends meet. Low pay has also led to a staffing crisis where last year nearly one in five Head Start teachers quit. NPR's Corey Turner says the average salary is around $40,000 a year compared to a preschool teacher who earns about $53,000 a year on average.
The Biden-Harris administration has created a rule requiring Head Start teachers to get a pay pump of as much as $10,000 a person. Here's the problem. Without Congress, local program directors are being told they have to pay for it, in some cases by cutting services. With the election just a week away, it's also worth noting the Republican Project 2025 calls for eliminating Head Start. We know Donald Trump has disavowed that project. I did ask his campaign for his position, and I got a vague quote about returning education to the states.
NPR's Corey Turner, he says some of those Head Start teachers are working second jobs as baristas. This is NPR.
For Kansas Public Radio News, I'm Laura Lorson with your regional headlines. New research shows food insecurity rose among children in all 105 counties in Kansas between 2021 and 2022. Food insecurity is defined as having limited or uncertain access to food, usually for socioeconomic reasons. The nonprofit Kansas Action for Children says one in five Kansas children experienced food insecurity in 2022. That year, the state saw its highest spike in child food insecurity rates in 10 years. Jessica Herrera Russell is with the nonprofit. She says the spike can largely be attributed to the end of pandemic era relief programs.
A lot of pandemic era programs really had far-reaching impacts on kids.
and a lot for the better.
Russell says Kansas lawmakers could ease food insecurity by reducing the cost of school meals and removing barriers to government assistance. As the state of Kansas is battling drought, about one in three residents think state and local governments aren't doing enough to conserve water. That's according to a new survey by the Docking Institute of Public Affairs at Forte State University. It found another approximately one-third of respondents think state and local governments are doing the right amount of water conservation. Less than 4% think the government is doing too much. About one in three respondents thought state or local government should pass new laws governing water conservation. Another third thought voluntary action was sufficient. Turning now to the weather, we have a nearly 100% chance of showers and storms this evening. Lows in the mid-40s are expected. It will be much less humid once this line of storms passes through. Tomorrow, sunshine and much cooler with highs topping out in the upper 50s. As of right now, we do have one severe thunderstorm watch for the KPR listening area. This is in effect until 7 o'clock tonight for Doniphan County, Kansas, Andrew, Atchison, Buchanan, Holt, and Nottoway counties in Missouri. There is a tornado watch to the south and west of the KPR listening area. The only KPR-covered county in that watch till 9 p.m. is Chase County. Stay tuned to KPR throughout the evening for more information.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Sony Pictures, presenting the new movie Here, reuniting the director, writer, and stars of Forrest Gump, a tale of love, loss, laughter, and life. Here is only in theaters this Thursday. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates, all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. Just in time for Halloween, the Commerce Department is out with a new report card on the U.S. economy. And it's got more treats than tricks. The report shows the economy grew at a healthy clip in July, August, and September. The ghosts of a feared recession have largely disappeared. And the American consumer is performing like a costumed superhero. NPR's Scott Horsley wrote that intro and has this report.
The U.S. economy has some good bones. Just look at all the Halloween decorations haunting front yards all over the country.
Skeletons are really hot. Spiders are hot. Cobwebs are really hot.
Nothing says discretionary spending like a $39 webcaster gun that shoots glow-in-the-dark cobwebs, like a hot glue gun on steroids. That's just one of the items you can find at David Mangelson's Halloween Crafts Superstore in Omaha, Nebraska.
My folks started it, and I was 11 years old when we opened the store. Family-run and selling fun.
This year, Americans will spend nearly $12 billion on candy, costumes, and other trick-or-treat accessories. And while some of us wait till the last minute, Mangelson says the hardcore Halloweeners have been getting ready since summer, adding to the Commerce Department's third-quarter sales tally.
They're thinking about it all year round, and they keep collecting this stuff. They just run out of places to store it.
So before all those skeletons go back in the closet, let's review the economic report card. The nation's gross domestic product grew at an annual rate of 2.8% in the third quarter, and consumer spending, the telltale heart of this economy, beat even faster. Americans increased their spending on cars, restaurant meals, and vacations during the quarter. Chief Economist Mark Zandi of Moody's Analytics says what's fueling all that spending is the healthy labor market.
Everyone's got a job. And, you know, just as long as people have a job and their wages are rising at a pace that's greater than the rate of inflation, that's the basis for continued strong spending, and that's what we're getting.
Business investment was also up during the quarter, as was spending by the federal government. One of the few weak spots in the GDP report was housing. Sales of existing homes and new construction have both been in a slump, weighed down by high mortgage rates. Still, Zandi says the overall economy in the U.S. is outperforming those in most other countries around the world.
The U.S. is leading the way, and actually, if you know, I travel a lot all over the world and talking to different business leaders and government officials, they marvel at our economy and how well it's performing and they wish they had some of our mojo.
Throughout the Biden-Harris administration, annual economic growth has averaged 3.2%, stronger than the Trump administration enjoyed even before the pandemic. Still, polls suggest many Americans are dissatisfied with the economy. While inflation has come down significantly in the last 2 years, people are still frustrated by the cumulative price hikes during the pandemic recovery. With less than a week to go before the presidential election, there are some signs people's attitudes about the economy are improving. Consumer confidence, as measured by the Conference Board, just notched its biggest monthly increase in 3.5 years. Dana Peterson, who's chief economist of the Conference Board, says people are feeling somewhat better about how the economy is doing now and where they think it's going in the future.
People see the economy through these partisan lenses, but the data are telling us that the economy is doing well enough. Now, that could change once we do have the election, and depending upon what the results are, we could see some implications for consumer confidence. But at least leading up to the election, we're not seeing people holding back on spending or anything like that.
At Mangelson Superstore in Omaha, that economic engine shows no sign of slowing. As soon as the sugar high of Halloween wears off, it'll be time to start prepping for Christmas. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
In the last election, voters in the Pacific Northwest sent 3 freshman Latina members to Congress, and they are not all from one party. The region is often presumed to offer easy wins for Democrats, but down-ballot races are actually a much stronger shade of purple. NPR congressional correspondent Claudia Griselis has more.
If you look at a typical political map of the United States, Oregon and Washington look stable. Neither state has voted for a Republican for president since 1984. But Oregon Congresswoman Andrea Salinas, a Democrat, says it's a different story down ballot.
We're all feeling like we're scraping tooth and nail to get ahead.
That's the freshman member on the campaign trail. She represents the state's largest concentration of Latino residents. And her 6th congressional district is one of the closest races in the country. And she's fighting for resources to keep her seat.
We are not a battleground state, and so when you have a presidential election happening, the battleground states really get the most attention.
She's not alone. She's also part of an Oregon duo who made history as the first Latina members to represent their state in Congress.
LCD! LCD!
Next door at a hyped-up rally in the state's 5th congressional district, Republican Congresswoman Lori Chavez de Remer is facing nearly identical dynamics, and she has a grave warning for supporters.
This race is going to be close, within the margin of error. Don't think for one minute it's not going to come down to just a few thousand votes that are going to separate us.
She flipped her district red in 2022, making it a key target for Republicans' efforts to keep control of the House. She's facing off against a popular Democratic state lawmaker who wants to flip the district back. But Chavez de Remer tells NPR she's used her time in Congress to deliver money and jobs to this district.
Yeah, it's important for Oregonians, so they're going to get out and vote. I'm looking forward to visiting with everybody, and we're going to win this thing.
She also has a major ally backing her at this Oregon City rally, House Speaker Mike Johnson, who's made multiple visits here.
The most important races where I am is reserved for the end of the cycle.
Another one of those Johnson stops comes an hour north in Washington's 3rd congressional district, where a similar dynamic is at play. It's represented by another Latina freshman incumbent, but she's a Democrat that Johnson hopes is ousted by a Republican opponent. Democrat Marie Glusenkamp-Perez staged one of the House's biggest flips in the last election cycle in deep Republican country near Vancouver.
This seat was drawn to be a red seat.
That's Glusenkamp-Perez during a stop on her RV tour. Her contested seat in Southwest Washington shares another trend in this area, a district closely divided along urban and rural lines. Her Republican opponent, retired Army Green Beret Joe Kent, says the party is on track to get the district back with help from having former President Donald Trump on the ticket.
The Republican Party here learned a lot of hard lessons in 2022.
That's Kent at a recent candidate forum. He says Republicans have presented a unified front.
If we spend an exorbitant amount of time and money destroying each other, that can cost us.
For her part, Glusenkamp-Perez has kept her own party at arm's length. issuing early warnings about President Biden's failed re-election bid and avoiding endorsement talk on Vice President Harris. She argues too often national politics eclipses local needs in her district, a common refrain here.
In rural communities, we have felt really frustrated about how much oxygen these national races get, and it feels like it's at the expense of the local issues.
These three members of Congress say party loyalty is not the way to win in their districts. It comes down to individual candidates breaking through to voters on local issues and connecting on identity. Claudia Rizales, NPR News, the Pacific Northwest.
This is NPR News. Right now, IV fluids are in short supply after Hurricane Helene hit a key factory. But drug shortages have been a problem for years. Hurricane or no hurricane, common cheap drugs that hospitals rely on are just sometimes unavailable. Sally Helm from NPR's Planet Money podcast explains the economics behind these shortages.
Jared Sibbett is a flight nurse in the Mountain West. He transports patients via helicopter or airplane.
Well, I mean, it's unpredictable, I guess. You could get somebody who fell off a cliff and broke their leg. You could get a bear mauling. So it keeps me on my toes.
Jared spoke to us without clearance from his higher-ups, so we're leaving the name of his hospital out. And he's noticed this problem. Drug shortages. Common generic drugs that he uses every day sometimes run out. This is a problem at hospitals all over the country, even for basic things like dextrose and saline, basically salt water and sugar water. These shortages are bad for patients.
The simpler the drug is, the more upsetting the feeling is. This problem is a solvable problem in a free market, so could we please just fix that already?
I set out to understand these shortages, and early on, I found a helpful guide.
I have been looking at these issues since 2011.
That's Marta Voshinska. She's a healthcare economist and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. She says most drugs that get hit by shortages are in a particular category. They're injectable drugs mostly administered in hospitals. And often the immediate cause of a shortage is a manufacturing problem. These injectable drugs have to be sterile. We don't want to inject unsafe things like bacteria straight into our veins.
It could also be metal shavings or glass particles. You do not want to have these contaminants in these products, right?
Marta says if something does go wrong at a factory, it might have to shut down for a bit. And boom, shortage. Many of these drugs have few manufacturers. They're generics, not under patent. Anyone can make them. And for drug makers, they're not all that profitable. They sell for a pretty low price.
There is this tremendous price pressure, and some of those life-saving drugs are costing us less than a cup of coffee.
And now we're at the heart of the economic mystery. Because if prices are too low, so low that we're getting shortages, why don't manufacturers just raise the price more? One possible reason? A lot of hospitals have pooled their buying power, negotiating as a group. That can drive prices down. There are also some rules that make it hard for manufacturers to raise prices too much. They're meant to keep healthcare costs down for patients and hospitals.
What are the good reasons to set things up to bring costs down?
What are the good reasons? We spend a lot of money on healthcare, and I don't even know how sort of to talk about this.
But Marta says the system we have now is missing something: a greater focus on supply chain resilience. Shortages would happen less often if manufacturers had a spare factory or a backup supplier. But to get that to happen, hospitals may need to pay more for these drugs.
We need to incentivize hospitals to pay attention to which manufacturers are reliable and put much more weight on that rather than just price.
Marta imagines a way to reward hospitals for taking proactive steps to prevent shortages, like by working with a higher quality manufacturer. Then that manufacturer could charge a higher price. It's a solution geared towards that supply chain resilience, which has value, especially to patients. But it's been hard to get anyone in this system to pay for it. Sally Helm, NPR News.
Support for Planet Money comes from Schwab, with Schwab investing themes like artificial intelligence, renewable energy, or pet passion. Over 40 themes to invest in. Learn more at schwab.com.
We are in the final stretch of this historic election season. Former President Trump and Vice President Harris are making their last big push before it all comes to a head on November 5th. I'm Scott Detrow. Join us for live special coverage of Election Night 2024 from NPR News. We will bring you the latest as the polls close and the vote totals roll in, with the context and analysis you need to stay informed.
Join us Tuesday night beginning at 7 o'clock on your KPR stations, NPR's coverage of Election Night.
Support for KPR comes from Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Kansas, committed to a healthier future for all Kansans with health care coverage for businesses and their employees. Learn more at bcbsks.com/business.
This is your place for NPR News from the University of Kansas, Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 FM in Lawrence, 96.1 FM in Lawrence, always online at kansaspublicradio.org.
Support for KPR comes from the Topeka Zoo, celebrating 90 years of smiles, memories, wildlife conservation, and education. Open daily from 9 to 5. Calendar of events and ticket information is found at topekazoo.org.
Stay with us coming up in our next half hour, an update of news headlines. Then, as November 5th approaches, local election officials are contending with an absolute fire hose of misinformation. We will talk about it and what people are planning to do about it coming up here on your KPR stations. Strong thunderstorms will be affecting Dickinson, Geary, Riley, Morris, parts of Pottawatomie, and southeastern Clay counties through 4:15. Strong thunderstorms extending from about 6 miles east of Longford to near Enterprise to about 4 miles southeast of Hillsboro. Take caution if you're in Manhattan, Junction City, and Abilene. It's 10 minutes before 4.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. War is always a disaster for civilians. What makes it even worse is when combatants flagrantly violate the laws and norms intended to shield civilians from the worst abuses. NPR's Greg Myrie has been covering two wars where many of those rules are being broken, the Russia-Ukraine fight and the Israel-Hamas battle.
I'm at the main children's hospital in Ukraine's capital, Kyiv, which is still scarred from a direct hit by a deadly Russian missile this summer. Flowers and stuffed animals are piled at the front gate. Repair work is ongoing at several damaged buildings. This is one of the most notorious Russian attacks on civilians, but there are many more.
We documented more than 78,000 episodes of war crimes.
Alexandra Matvichuk leads the Center for Civil Liberties. The Ukrainian group won the Nobel Peace Prize 2 years ago for its work in compiling Russian abuses.
I personally interviewed hundreds and hundreds of people who were beaten, raped, their fingers were cut, their nails were drilled, there were electrical shocks.
The group works from a modest Soviet-era apartment building in the center of Kyiv, just a couple of miles from the children's hospital.
Probably in the most documented war in the human history. It's because we have now digital instruments which provides human rights groups an opportunity to collect evidence and to identify perpetrators.
The big challenge, she says, is turning this mountain of evidence into a workable international system that holds those perpetrators responsible. The Geneva Conventions established the fundamental laws of war in the wake of World War II, and they marked their 75th anniversary in August.
The Geneva Conventions created this basic idea that civilians really should be insulated from the worst harms of war.
Ona Hathaway is a professor at Yale Law School who often writes on the rules of war. She says several current wars are eroding decades of work to prevent or at least limit abuses.
You can't help but look around the world and not worry that these basic innovations and accomplishments of the post-war era are being undermined. We're seeing civilians being not just killed in war, but it appears being targeted in war.
Take Gaza, where Israeli military operations have killed more than 43,000 Palestinians, a majority of them women and children, according to Palestinian officials. Sari Bashi is a head of global research for Human Rights Watch.
The Israeli military's disregard for civilian protections has deteriorated dramatically in the last 20 years. They are authorizing just massive bombings with very heavy bombs in urban areas where you know you will kill hundreds of children.
Bashi is based in the West Bank and is sharply critical of the ways Israel and Hamas are conducting the war.
Hamas-led groups were able to kill more than 800 Israeli civilians on October 7th because it was planned at the top and executed downward. And that's why Human Rights Watch has called those attacks a crime against humanity.
Hamas, designated a terrorist group by Israel in the West, says its attacks are in pursuit of Palestinian rights. Israel says it's not targeting civilians, but faces Hamas fighters using Palestinian civilians as human shields. Ona Hathaway says these scenarios, where a state military is fighting a non-state group, complicates humanitarian efforts.
What we're seeing is a real change in the nature of warfare. And these Nazi actor groups have tried to, frankly, take advantage of the rules by sometimes using them to shield themselves from violence. And so placing themselves in or near schools or hospitals.
For example, a state army, like Israel, has repeatedly attacked schools and hospitals that are traditionally protected, though there are rare exceptions.
If it's being used by militants, it can become a military objective.
The Russia-Ukraine war is a state versus state war, the kind rarely seen these days. Russia consistently strikes Ukrainian civilian targets and has seized thousands of Ukrainian civilians, including many children. Christina Schuder is with the Ukrainian group Where Are Our People, which tracks the missing Ukrainian children.
We know the names, we know the history and all background of almost 20,000 of Ukrainian kids.
Russia claims it's protecting children who've lost parents in the war. But Ukraine says Russia has kidnapped the children and is systematically erasing their identities and raising them as Russians. The International Criminal Court at The Hague has issued an arrest warrant for Russian leader Vladimir Putin, citing the forced deportation of these children. At the same court, prosecutors are seeking an arrest warrant for alleged war crimes by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Prosecutors were also seeking the arrest of three Hamas leaders, though they've now been killed by Israel. In Ukraine, the courts have prosecuted a few low-level Russian soldiers. Alexandra Matvichuk says this is just one of many approaches that should be pursued. Victims, she says, often seek different things.
For some people, justice means to see the perpetrators behind the bars. For another, justice means to get compensations. For some people, justice means to get opportunity to know truth. What happened with their beloved ones?
Far too often, she says, justice never arrives in any form. Greg Myrie, NPR News, reporting from Ukraine and Israel.
The world of Cuban music lost an iconic figure this week. Buena Vista Social Club trumpeter Manuel Mirabal died on Monday.
Mirabal was born 30 miles outside of Havana, Cuba, in 1933. He was given the nickname El Guajiro, which roughly translates to country boy, by Puerto Rican singer Tito Gomez.
Mirabal picked up the trumpet at 18 and didn't put it down for more than 70 years. He was a member of several prominent Cuban orchestras. Then in 1996, Buena Vista Social Club was born.
The group, made of veteran Cuban musicians, released an album of the same name in 1997. It was an unlikely smash, as NPR once put it. The album catapulted them to worldwide acclaim, ultimately earned them a Grammy.
Particularly notable was Mirabal's trumpet solos. Years later, Mirabal released his debut solo album, the Latin Grammy-nominated Buena Vista Social Club Presents Manuel Guajiro Mirabal.
In a radio interview in 2000, Mirabal spoke about his relationship with his trumpet. He said he always had it with him, taking it apart, cleaning it, and caring for it. Mirabal saying his wife and he joke that the trumpet is his first love, she's his second.
Mirabal did not smoke or drink, so he could stay in top form to play his trumpet. And he says it was a constant source of inspiration.
When you play a solo, he told the interviewer, you express what comes to you. And that, he said, makes me happy.
Mirabal was one of the last surviving members of the Buena Vista Social Club. He was 91.
Yo me voy. Thanks for listening to All Things Considered.
We're live, we're local, we are Kansas Public Radio from the University of Kansas, KANU and KANU HD1, Lawrence 91.5, KANH and KANH HD1, Emporia 89.7, KANV and KANV HD1, Olsburg Junction City 91.3, KANQ Chanute 90.3. We're always on the web at kansaspublicradio.org, or you can tell your smart speaker to play Kansas Public Radio. I want to give you a quick update on the weather situation. Strong thunderstorms will be affecting Dickinson, Geary, Western Riley, Western Morris, West Central Pottawatomie, and Southeastern Clay counties through 415 Doppler radar, tracking strong thunderstorms along a line from about 6 miles east of Longford to near Enterprise to about 4 miles southeast of Hillsboro. It's all moving to the northeast at 70 miles per hour. Wind gusts up to 50 miles per hour are being reported. Gusty winds could knock down small tree limbs and blow around unsecured objects. Locations affected by these storms include Manhattan, Junction City, Abilene, Harrington, Ogden, Grandview Plaza, Chapman, Solomon, Wakefield, Riley, Enterprise, White City, Milford, Leonardville, Hope, Dwight, Woodmine, Randolph, Willsey, and Parkerville. This also includes I-70 between mile markers 267 and 311. If you're outdoors, consider seeking shelter inside a building. Again, these are strong thunderstorms, not quite at the severe cutoff, but still hazardous. So use caution if you are driving through that area or in that area. There's also a severe thunderstorm watch till 7 p.m. for Doniphan County, Kansas, and a tornado watch till 9 for Chase County.
Going into the 2024 election cycle, we are arguably facing the most complex